It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up on Central Time, a group of Democrats wants to increase the accessibility of Wisconsin produce to recipients of federal food benefits. We'll talk to one of the lawmakers behind the idea. First, according to numbers out yesterday, the state took in $71 million more in taxes during the 2014-15 fiscal year than had been projected previously by the Legislative Fiscal Bureau. Income and insurance taxes were below expectations, but corporate, cigarette sales, and other taxes more than made up for it. This comes after a long and politically tense budget debate aimed at closing a $2.2 billion budget shortfall initially in the state. The new fiscal year began on July 1st. Here with us now is Todd Berry, president of the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance. Todd, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me back.
So what, if anything, does this latest revenue update tell us about Wisconsin's money or Wisconsin's economy and how money is flowing into state coffers?
Yeah. I think the short answer is nothing. Just some context. $70 million or so is really pretty small when you spend, you know, $15 billion a year. So that, you know, that's about a 0.5% or less difference. So it really isn't much. Now, the flip side of that is we were going to begin the new budget, which we are now in, with essentially no carryover surplus. It was $254,000. So to come in with $71 million at least sort of raises our head above the water, and it will have the effect of carrying over and making the ending balance in the budget that was just passed a little larger. But whether it's $87 million, which was going to be the ending surplus, or $160 million or so, which it might be now, you know, in the context of what we spend, that's less than 1%. Those are the kinds of narrow balances that we had going into the 2008 recession when, frankly, our budgets were blown apart. So as long as the economy holds up and the stock market doesn't, you know, fall apart, you know, it's nice to have another 70 or million or so around, but, you know, let's be honest, it's not big stuff in the big picture.
So it sounds like there's a lot of knocking on wood there with a tight or a close budget situation. But
yeah, it's better than not having it.
Well, in past perspective, does this mean that those Fiscal Bureau estimates, and these are projections, estimates based on what they know at the time, and they're trying to predict the economic future, which, of course, for anyone doing that is tough to do when they're that close, 70-ish million. Does that mean they're doing a pretty good job of that?
Well, in the short run, they were pretty close. But you got to remember that of that $71 million, $70 million of it comes from underestimating corporate income tax revenues. In other words, if we take the corporate income tax aside, there was no extra revenue. And it is always very difficult to estimate revenues, and particularly the corporate income tax, because it is so volatile. You know, we should also remember, though, that when estimates for this year that just ended were done in January of 2014, they were much higher than the January 2015 estimate. In other words, maybe we underestimated by a little bit that $70 million, but another way to look at it is we initially overestimated by several hundred million. So, I mean, the bottom line is it's hard to estimate revenues, and, you know, an error of 1% or 2% can be expected. And when you balance budgets tighter than that, which we are doing again, you're making yourself vulnerable. So I don't mean to rain on the legislature and governor's parade. We'll take the $71 million, but the budget that was passed remains very narrowly balanced. And any little blip in the economy could push that up or down.
Talking to Todd Berry from the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance about new information, new data from the state on revenue, $70 million or so higher than estimated, not a huge percentage, Todd Berry points out. So some people across the political spectrum might hear this as, hey, we've got $71 million extra dollars to work with, which could be tax relief or could go toward education or higher education. Would you warn either side against either of those options?
Well, history would suggest in 2001, in 2008, and most recently in the last year or two, that every time we pass budgets that have these balances of 50, 100, 150 million, which again, in the Madison context, is a spit in Lake Mendota, it's too little money to rush out and do something with, because we might end up in the red. I mean, let's remember, the stock market has done some big moves in the last week or so. What that means is if the gains don't reappear, that when people file income taxes next year, they're going to be reporting stock losses. And that means income tax revenue will be less than expected. This is really nothing to write home about.
So it sounds like you're thinking, hey, let's think of this as rainy day money a little bit in the meantime. This is a two-year budget, and a lot could happen between now and the end of that 2 years?
Exactly. I mean, if you talk to state budget experts around the country, they would say that at minimum, Wisconsin should have about a 2% cushion. Even with this new money, we have less than a 1% cushion. So we're still skating on thin ice.
Now, I use the phrase rainy day fund, which this actually is not, I should point out. So how are we doing? This has been a decades-long conversation in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
We've talked to you about this over the years. Have we gotten any better at having a rainy day fund, some money set aside for, I don't know, the next recession or something?
Yeah. There is at the moment something, I think, around $270, $280 million in the rainy day fund. It's good to have that. But again, tax collections can swing hundreds of millions of dollars in a matter of days or weeks. So, and I might add that last year, the legislature and the governor specifically wrote into the statutes that they would not have to make a rainy day fund deposit out of this extra revenue. So we aren't going to get to put any of this in the long-term rainy day fund because they exempted themselves from the law.
Do you have any hope that the idea of a rainy day fund and building it up and maybe putting slight excesses like this into it will happen anytime in our lifetimes?
Right now the law says if we have some surprise revenue, we have to put half of it in the rainy day fund, although they've exempted themselves from that this year. If we have some surprises next year, maybe a little gold in the rainy day fund. But since this law was enacted in the 80s, no governor, no legislature has ever consciously and by choice made a deposit to the rainy day fund. They've only done it when the state law has forced them to do it. And as I just mentioned, this year they exempted themselves from even that. So Wisconsin really historically has looked pretty fiscally weak need compared to almost any state in the country, except for Illinois, who's the poster child for just about anything not to do.
We'll leave it there. Todd, thanks a lot for joining us, as always.
Yeah, bye-bye.
That's Todd Berry. He's president of the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance. Numbers out yesterday showed the state took in $71 million more than projected over the last fiscal year. Large amount of money from a personal perspective, not so much, he says, in the context of the state budget. It's prime harvest season in Wisconsin, and farmers markets and groceries around the state are brimming with fresh local produce. A group of Democratic lawmakers wants to make that produce more accessible to recipients of federal SNAP benefits as a way to promote both healthy eating and state agriculture. The proposed initiative is called Grow Wisconsin. It would double the purchasing power of food share enrollees when they buy Wisconsin-produced vegetables, fruits, meat, and dairy. The bill was proposed last month. State Representative Lisa Subek from Madison is a co-sponsor. She joins us now. Representative Subek, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So where did this idea come from for this Grow Wisconsin?
Sure. So, earlier in this year, we had a group of Republicans who had brought forth a proposal in the state assembly that would demand that individuals who are participating in food share SNAP be limited to purchasing only certain foods. And it was sort of an absurd list of foods that came from another program that didn't serve the same population. And, you know, when you started getting at what was their intent, part of their intent was to increase nutrition among SNAP participants. And that's not a bad intent, but certainly it was the wrong way to go about doing it. Limiting people's options was not the way to get people to eat healthier. So we started taking a look, and Representative Andy Jorgensen sort of took the lead on it, and a number of us worked together with him to look at what is it that's being done elsewhere that does have a positive impact on nutrition habits among SNAP participants. And one of the things that we discovered was that, of course, incentives work better than simply limiting what people can eat, but also that when people make healthy choices, it costs more. In order to buy fresh fruits and produce and things, it actually costs people more than some of the quick and easy things, ready-made foods that they were purchasing. So in order to compensate for that, what we've put together is a proposal called Grow Wisconsin, where we would incentivize purchasing healthy, locally grown fruits and vegetables by doubling people's food stamp dollars, within a small portion of their SNAP benefits, but doubling those up for purchases on Wisconsin-grown fruits, vegetables, and meats and some other items.
So how would that work on a practical level? How would a participant know what counts, what they get double their benefits for, where to go to get it, that sort of thing?
Sure. So some grocery stores would participate, and as well, we would hope that most, if not all, farmers markets would participate. And we've actually seen a similar program here in Madison where, you know, essentially anything you buy at the farmers market or pretty much anything you buy qualifies for the program, anything that's a fresh fruit or vegetable. And folks just stop by a booth and they actually are charged a portion of their food stamps, and they get double that in coupons that they can then go out and spend at that farmers market. Similarly, the same sort of a thing could happen at a grocery store. We've had great success on a very small scale with a similar privately funded program here in Madison that, you know, serves, I think, with 600 people over the last 18 weeks that they ran it. And, you know, it's kind of an exciting program. They do the same thing in Michigan, and they have a double-up food box, and it's been wildly successful. It's really been not so hard to run and a great way for folks who have a hard time tapping into healthy food choices to be able to afford to do so.
So part of the problem, I would think, would be getting the word out both to participants that they can do this and to food providers that they can participate in it and how they would do that. Is that part of the bill, the outreach?
Absolutely. Outreach is a part of the bill. And right now what we have proposed is doing a pilot program in Dane County, Rock County, and Milwaukee County, which gives us an opportunity, if this passes, to promote the program on a smaller scale and then be able to replicate that elsewhere in the state, assuming the program is successful. But certainly outreach is critical to ensuring a program like this would work. And if this bill were to pass, we would be, our staff, the department would be reaching out to potential grocery stores and farmers markets to participate, and certainly then marketing it to food share and SNAP participants as well.
Does this assume that everyone participating in SNAP has access to this kind of produce? We hear this idea of food deserts where there are neighborhoods, mostly low-income neighborhoods, maybe with limited transportation options and limited availability of these kind of foods.
Sure, and this bill does not, unfortunately, solve that problem. However, I have proposed a companion bill that would provide tax credits for grocery stores that would be willing to locate in neighborhoods where we have those food deserts, Again, that bill's been introduced. It has not moved forward at all yet, has many of the same co-sponsors, but essentially it is a bill that would incentivize placing grocery stores in underserved areas where there are high rates of poverty to ensure that we start to move away from having those food deserts so that people have access to good, healthy food. Right now, too many of our communities are served by simply a corner market or a convenience store, and that doesn't work for somebody who wants to, A, be economical, and B, eat healthy.
Talking to State Representative Lisa Subek from Madison about legislation looking to create a Grow Wisconsin initiative, allowing people who receive federal food benefits to double part of their benefits when they buy Wisconsin fresh and local produce. Cost, Representative Subek, the budget is already passed. This would cost some money. How much do you estimate this would cost the state?
Well, the way the bill is written for the pilot program, the bill would appropriate about $144,900 of general purpose revenue during the 2015-17 fiscal biennium. So, you know, we're looking at something, you know, around $150,000, and that's really a small price tag to make a whole lot of difference. So I think it has incredible potential. It's something we can do at a reasonable cost to really be able to help our neighbors in need be able to access healthier food options.
Let's spell out those benefits a little more. What do we in general as taxpayers get out of putting money into helping food aid recipients get local produce?
Sure, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, but we spend millions every year in addressing health issues, whether through Medicaid, whether through other health initiatives, but addressing health issues that are directly the result of obesity. You know, that can be diabetes, that can be heart problems, other diseases related to obesity. So every opportunity we have to help people get on a path to healthy eating is one more way to prevent some of those health problems that taxpayers end up paying significantly more for in the long run.
And you mentioned three counties to start as a pilot program. Do you see this going statewide eventually, if it gets started in the first place?
Absolutely. I think this has a great potential to go statewide. I mean, we know from looking at the program in Michigan, the success that a program like this can have. We also know that a much smaller version of this program, serving parts of the city of Madison, has been incredibly successful. So I think that we would see great success in these three counties, and I think that counties across the state would be looking to us to expand this to better serve the entire state.
And how do you see this benefiting food producers? Is this going to be enough volume to make a difference for the people who are growing and selling local produce?
Sure. You know, I mean, I think that for a large food producer, this would be a small amount that this might bring in additional revenues. But so many of our farmers market vendors are really small local producers for whom a little bit of additional sales makes an incredible difference. So the idea that this bill focuses not only on healthy produce but on locally grown produce really has the potential to make a great impact economically for farmers who are growing that produce, who are trying to run their small businesses, providing food here locally.
Maybe this is getting too far down in the weeds, but is it going to be tough for a vendor, whether at a farmer's market or a grocery store, to know what's on the list? What is the healthy local produce that counts that this this benefit would double for?
Sure. You know, our goal is to keep it simple. And so I believe at a farmer's market, you know, we would establish criteria, but we would work to keep it very simple. I know in the Madison program, one of the things that they did with the farmers markets was they just said anything you purchase at the farmers market is fine. You know, I think we could do something similar. Maybe we'd say fruits, vegetables, but not prepared foods. You know, there's different ways to define that, but I think we would work really hard to keep this simple because we don't want to be a burden on the vendor or on the grocery store. You know, we want to make this as easy as possible.
I mentioned outreach earlier. You are a Democrat, as are your co-sponsors. You're the minority party in both houses of the legislature. What kind of outreach are you doing to your Republican colleagues to make this a possibility?
Sure. Certainly, we have been doing some reaching out to Republican colleagues. Thus far, we do not have any Republican co-sponsors on the bill. And, you know, I find that disappointing. I think that in some ways it's quite disingenuous. The Republicans came forth and said, we want to help people eat more nutritiously. And here's something that's tried and true and shown to work. And we struggled to get any of them on as co-sponsors. So that's disappointing. I'm still hopeful. Certainly, we are requesting that the chair of the Public Benefits Committee, where this has been referred, hold a hearing on it. We're still waiting to see if that will happen. But again, I'm hopeful that I'm hopeful that we'll be able to move forward with that.
And if your hopes come true, do you have a timeline for when you would like to see this in effect?
You know, again, I'm not sure that I know what the ideal timeline would be. What I would say is the sooner the better. And clearly, we're coming up on the end of, you know, the summer farmers market season. But if we were to have something like this in place for the next farmers market season, you know, perhaps by next spring, that would be really fantastic.
Representative Subek, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That was State Representative Lisa Subek from Madison talking about the Grow Wisconsin bill that she's co-sponsoring. The proposal would double the purchasing power for food share recipients when they buy Wisconsin-produced fruits, vegetables, meat, and dairy. As we get closer to the start of the school year, students all over the state are gearing up for their first football, soccer, volleyball games of the season, and parents are getting ready to cheer them on. That's not always a positive experience for everyone, as parents can go beyond cheering to coaching, maybe even verbal abuse of players or coaches or referees. The Baraboo School District has come up with a new parent and fan code of conduct that they hope will encourage a more positive and supportive atmosphere at sporting events. School officials brought together students, parents, and coaches from the community to help develop that plan, and a physical copy of the code of conduct will appear in their fall sports program. A lot of the ideas there could probably apply to any youth sporting event. We're joined now by Jim Langkamp. He's the athletic director for the Baraboo School District. Jim, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome. It's a privilege to be on with you, Rob.
So why did the district want to come up with this parent-fan code of conduct?
There's probably, you know, I'd say there's two overall reasons for it. First of all, you know, I don't believe our community is really any different than most that I've been around. I've been with, you know, around high school athletic director for 21 years in a couple different districts, and I do some softball officiating and umpiring in the spring as well. So, you know, as I've gone around to different school districts, again, I don't think our challenges are any different than anybody else in the state. So, again, pretty typical year last year, but over the course of the year, you know, again, most athletic directors you talk to will tell you a story or two about a, you know, kind of an ugly incident that has happened at their school over the course of the year. And so, you know, whenever you get a couple of incidents like that happen, you know, I think we look in the mirror and say, okay, how can we get better at this, and how can we make this a better experience for everybody?
You don't have to get into the specifics, but what are some examples of the kinds of negative behaviors that you've seen and heard about as an athletic director?
You know, the ones that really catch your attention are the ones where it's kind of, you know, in your face kind of behavior. So it's, you know, it's more than just, you know, booing from the stands or, you know, verbally, you know, kind of expressing your disagreement with a call or something like that. But it's, you know, it's a case of maybe a official coming off the court or coming off the field at the end of a game and having a parent, you know, get in their face and make a comment to them, or, you know, whether it's officials or coaches, same thing. You know, I think most coaches could probably tell you some horror stories about the way that some coaches get treated. You know, if they, again, lose a game or have a losing season. And so, you know, the coaching world, it's a tough world right now. And, you know, and that kind of leads into where, you know, our second goal with this was, you know, I've hired in the last 2 years, we've hired 8 or 9 head varsity coaches. And, you know, as we, again, like anybody else, we want to figure out, okay, how can we build successful programs? To me, it starts with coaching stability. And, you know, a number of the coaches that we've hired are inexperienced, you know, as a head varsity coach. And so maybe this is their first experience with this position, type of position. And, you know, I want those coaches to feel safe and feel that they're supported, and again, kind of limit and try to do our best to limit the type of, again, sometimes abuse that they're subjected to.
It sounds like another benefit, Jim, might be for the student athletes themselves and the role models they're seeing in action, the behavior they're learning and how they feel about sports and public behavior.
Absolutely. You know, and that was one of the great things of the, you know, we formed this code over two different meetings, and as you mentioned in your intro, the, you know, it was formed with coaches, parents, and students. And, you know, again, over the years, I've been a part of committees where students were part of the committee, but it almost felt like that was just a symbolic gesture. In this committee, it was really the opposite. In fact, when it came time for groups to speak, you know, one of our first rules was that the students speak first because we wanted to hear from them first. And, yeah, the, you know, a couple of the items in the code really kind of came directly from them, where, you know, they talked about, you know, for example, one of the items in our code, you know, said basically that as a parent, you'll give your child some time and space after a contest, except for praise and encouragement. And what that means is you know, it's, the students had said, you know, there's sometimes after a game or, you know, whether it's a tough game or, again, a tough loss, we don't necessarily want, you know, mom and dad to relive the whole game. You know, we don't want to replay the whole game and you know, dissect and question, again, coach's moves or this player did this or that. You know, sometimes kids at the end of the game, they just want to kind of decompress and just forget about the game for a little bit. And when they're ready, you know, yeah, they'll talk to mom and dad. But so you know, it's things like that that you're exactly right. You know, there's some things in here that really, again, came from students and what we heard from students to make their experience better. And again, that was a very valuable piece to this whole process.
We're talking to Jim Langkamp. He's athletic director for the Baraboo School District about the district's new code of conduct for parents and fans at district athletic events. You can join in, by the way, at 800-642-1234. Do you see good or bad behavior from parents at youth sporting events that you've been to, whether it's at a school or in club sports? 800-642-1234. Jim, let's get some more into what's in that code. As I look at it, I think, okay, oh, I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't get up in the referee's face or anything.
Right.
One thing I am guilty of is the first thing on the list, coaching from the sidelines. So why was it important to get that out there? Hey, parents, you're not the coach. Pipe down.
Yep. Well, and you're exactly right. There is so much of that, and like I said, I've sometimes get a unique seat to that. Again, as an umpire, you know, set up behind home plate, obviously there, and you can hear again a parent even coaching their daughter at bat and saying, you know, step a little bit toward the plate or move back, you know, and it's, you know, again, as a student, you know, it's confusing to them. You know, it puts them really in a tough position. You know, if let's say as a parent you disagree with what the way your coach has taught it, it puts the student really in a tough position because they basically either have to ignore their coach, who obviously makes the decisions on things like playing time and you know, playing positions and things like that. Or they have to disappoint and ignore their parent. And again, none of us, you know, none of us want to be put in a position like that because, again, we all want to impress our parents and we want to satisfy them. And so, you know, when you have two different voices telling you two different things, the student's really in a bad spot, and it's really a no-win situation for them. So again, that was certainly something that's, you know, benefiting for the student.
And based on the dirty looks I got from my kids when I did this, I'm guessing this is one that the students you talked to were very supportive of changing.
Absolutely. Yep. Yeah, there was, you know, no debate or discussion or dissension really on that. That was, you know, that was a pretty easy one for us to agree that is the best thing. And again, you know, it's certainly, you know, at night after the game when they go home and talk about things, you know, again, people are going to have different opinions and maybe the parent, again, gives them a little tip here or there. But again, certainly at the games and at the practices, that's really not the right time to address those things.
Yeah, and my secret has been I've learned to mumble it to myself on the sidelines so no one else can hear it. Now, I want to get to another one of them, a 24-hour rule, where if, hey, you're a parent, you've got a concern, as long as it's not about kid safety, if you've got a concern about coaches' decisions, athletic policies, don't bring it to the coach within 24 hours of the game. Why is that important?
So that's something, actually, you know, I know the code itself is unique. The 24-hour rule, though, is something that's pretty common already around the schools that I'm familiar with. So really the purpose of that is, let's take basketball, for example. If, you know, you're upset about, boy, why wasn't my son didn't get to play the whole second half, you know, and you know, maybe the parents up there just stewing for the whole second half and all that. And, again, maybe you lose a tough game. You know, when a parent comes down out of the stands at that point, they're going to be emotionally pretty charged. You know, the coach is going to be emotionally charged just from the adrenaline of the game. And, again, win or lose, you know, their emotions are running high. So, to try to have a logical, rational kind of conversation in that scene is probably not likely to happen. And so so typically things aren't going to go well in one side or the other, or both are going to say something that they may regret the next day. So, again, to try to protect both parties, we ask them just, you know, please go home and sleep on it. We say this also applies to email as well. You know, we ask them not to go home and fire off a 2-page email, you know, and hit send on it. Because again, you know, many of us have made that mistake at some point in our life and came to regret it, you know, not too much later. So we ask them just to sleep on it. Again, let's let the emotions die down a little bit. And when you call, you know, call coach or call the athletic director the next day, let's arrange for a chance for us to all sit down and get around the same table. And again, we want to talk to parents. We want to work things out. We don't want things stewing and you know, festering over the course of days and weeks. But again, yeah, let's just have a little cooling off period and come back the next day. And you know, again, I'm probably still some emotion, but it's just not that raw emotion that you see at, you know, at the end of a contest.
We're talking to the Baraboo School District's athletic director, Jim Langkamp, about a new sportsmanship policy the district has put in place this year aimed at better behavior on the sidelines and in the stands, mainly from the parents. We want to hear from you. Have parents or fans become too invested in kids' sporting events? Do you wish the district in your area had a code of conduct like this one? If you play youth sports, do you ever wish mom or dad would just pipe down? Call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking right now about the Baraboo School District's new code of conduct policy for parents and fans. And you can join the conversation maybe with a story in your neck of the woods. Do you think fans should follow a code of conduct policy at youth sporting events, at a school or a club? Have you ever yelled something from the sidelines and regretted it? Have parents or fans gotten too into the game, and do you wish your district had a code like this? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post a comment on the Central Time Facebook page, where we have a link to an article that lists all the steps in that code of conduct. Jim Langkamp stays with us. He's the Baraboo School District's athletic director. We'll go to our callers now with Dennis on the line in Ripon. Dennis, hi.
Unfortunately, this code of conduct should probably be started at a younger age, because as a coach in different Y programs through the years, you can see which parents are probably going to continue their abusiveness to their coaches and refs, and, you know, and right on up into high school. It's sad to see some of these kids getting talked to by the parents. It should start at a younger age, I think.
Dennis, thanks a lot for the call. So not to wait until high school, but I think this will apply to any sporting event in your district at whatever level, right, Jim?
It's at this point, it's a high school code is where we're starting with it. But it's a great point, I think, that Dennis made, because when we developed this code, we took five samples from around the country. Three were from school districts. One was just a youth sports code, and one was a youth lacrosse club. So we kind of had a different take of those. But I absolutely agree. I think that the problems that we see by the high school age are or things that probably have gone on for years, you know, before this, and maybe that's why some people are a little startled or shocked by this now.
Thanks a lot for that call. You say a lot of these have gone on for years. One point in this code of conduct is newer, though, a code of conduct with social media during and after the game.
You're right. And so, you know, had I sat down and just, you know, tried to come up with a code myself, I don't know that I would have thought about that. But again, as we pulled in these samples, one of the five had mention of that. And again, I think we all kind of thought, oh, you know, boy, that is an important piece nowadays. Yeah, it just seems like in the last even 3 or 4 years that has taken off. You know, and with the social media piece, it's not like we're going to, you know, on Friday nights just scan over Facebook and all the Twitter hashtags and things like that. What typically happens, and this is the same, you know, with our students during the school day, what typically happens is if somebody is across the line and just over the top on some social media behavior and communication, somebody else becomes offended by it, and whether it's, again, a specific person or maybe it's a fellow parent or student that says, look, so-and-so is, look at the stuff that they're just spewing on Twitter and Facebook, and I don't want to read this anymore. It's offensive, and can you please do something about it? So again, it's I'm glad we have that in there. I think it is very appropriate for this day and age, and it's something that we, again, that if it's brought to our attention, we, you know, we now have the means to address it with somebody.
Back to our callers now with Kevin in Sparta. Kevin, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you think?
Well, you know, from being a past coach in wrestling in the state, in Wisconsin Rapids, to be honest with you, it seems that most times the programs that excel or achieve higher at a higher degree usually have a strong group of parents that have started those kids at a very young age, and very involved parents. Now, some of that may be good, some of that may be bad, but it seems like these parents that have been involved all these years, most, I would say, are pretty knowledgeable in the sport. And I don't think that cutting them out or pinning them down, or I don't know how you would, what you would say, this code of conduct, I would hate to have that.
Gotcha. I think I see where you're going, Kevin. So Jim, can we encourage that sort of supportive parenting that helps build strong programs while at the same time not having that cross the line into negative behavior?
Absolutely, and Kevin brings up a great point. And I think as a school district, what our, you know, charge is to make sure that, you know, include those people in a positive manner. And for example, in our district, what I recommend to our coaches is, for example, you know, there's so much summer training now and summer workouts and things, and I think that's a great opportunity to involve parents. And absolutely, you know, if you've got some expertise in your town, we'd be silly not to tap into those folks and get them on board in a positive, you know, productive way. And this certainly isn't meant to push those folks aside, but again, I think if you have that expertise in most communities, you know, yeah, you struggle to find those experts. So I think when you're fortunate enough to have them, I think you do have to include them in your programs.
Thanks to Kevin in Sparta. Now we go to Kevin in Janesville. Kevin, hi.
Hi. My question, comment is, I think this is a great idea and it's long overdue. However, say Baraboo institutes this code of conduct, yet the next school district over doesn't, and now say visiting fans are totally out of control. What's the procedure, punishment, enforcement, consequence?
Oh, interesting question. So Jim Langkamp from the Baraboo School District, what are the consequences for the home fans as well as the away fans?
That is a very difficult question. It's a difficult thing, and it does happen, and you know, I've had that happen where, you know, basically our responsibility, you know, we try to keep, especially our student section, you know, doing appropriate cheers and things like that, and then, you know, the minute the other school students start something, of course, you know, our students look at me or our supervisors say, hey, well, you know, what are you going to do about that? And again, you know, we we try to address it the best we can. You know, typically our message is, look, you know, we have high standards, and not every school has those, and let's be classy. Our goal is always to be the classiest again, student body or student section or fan section in our conference. So, you know, we kind of use it as an example of, you know, that's if that's how they want to represent their community, you know, go right ahead. But we're going to rise above that.
You know, it seems like policy aside, Jim, what you're trying to accomplish here is to encourage a mindset among parents of athletes and fans in the community. What do you want people thinking as they come in to enjoy, you know, the local football, the high school football game or whichever sport they're out to boost?
Right. You know, and right. We want, you know, and you should be able to take your family and even things like, you know, coaches, spouses or coaches' family should be able to sit in the stands and not be uncomfortable and have to hear some things that are just out of line. It should be a family-friendly place. And, you know, quite honestly, this code really isn't, you know, for our community, I don't believe it's anything new or it's, you know, that we're changing the way we do business. All we really did was put down in writing some things that we've stood for and try to stand for every day. So, you know, we've just kind of decided to recommit our efforts to say, look, let's be classy. We want when people leave, whether it's officials that work here or other coaches, we want them to leave and say, wow, that was just a classy group of players and coaches and fans. It was just, you know, it's just a great night of high school sports. You know, that's our goal that we want people to leave with.
Good place to leave it, Jim. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. I appreciate the opportunity.
That's Jim Langkamp. He's athletic director for the Baraboo School District, discussing the new code of conduct for fans and parents at sporting events there. You can keep sharing your thoughts at the Central Time Facebook page.